Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, in this episode, it has occurred to me that I have been neglecting the full breadth of culture within the Western canon, and I specifically wanted to do something this week celebrating Black culture and give that the time and attention that it deserved. And I thought the best way to do that would be to take a look at The Wire, which was a TV series back from early in 2000 when they looked at the drug trade in Baltimore, an American city. It's a good series, so I don't know if you've seen it. You should have done. If you haven't, go and watch it. But it's very good, and it's like I think it's like five seasons. And it kind of follows, you know, both the police department, a few civilians, and the drug traffickers and the sort of interplay that goes on between them. It's really good TV, quite engaging. So if you're just looking for something to watch, I think it holds up. There's a lot of economic lessons that you can actually draw from it, interestingly. The reason I watched it again is because I went on a camping holiday with the kids, and the thing with women and kids is they fall asleep really early. So I had the evenings to myself, and I sort of took along The Wire and rewatched it. Fascinating watching it again all these years later, for a number of reasons. One, because it shows how good the 2000s were, even in Baltimore. Even crime-ridden Baltimore kind of basically worked. All the functions and, you know, the institutions, they worked badly, but they worked, which is an interesting contrast with today, even in Baltimore. Also, I quite liked it because obviously the early 2000s was a great time in human history. Now, I wonder if perhaps I'm saying that because it is a tendency of old men to think back to whenever they were in the 20s was the very height of civilization, and they're just confusing the fact that you know, they could run around a lot and you know, get up to all sorts of stuff that young men do, and they kind of miscalculate that with being the, you know, the high times. I don't think that's the case, because I don't think any Zoomers will be looking back on now and saying that that now was a great time. But anyway, 2000s was good, so it was a bit of a blast from the past watching people carry around CD Walkmans and you know, stuff like that. But no, early 2000s was a good time. We had mobile phones and we had a bit of internet, and you know, stuff was generally good, all more or less sensible.
Hey, yo, lesson here, babe. You come at the king, you best not miss.
And then we had some good TV. So I thought, let's dive into that. The Wire has been not just, well, it wasn't just me who liked it. A lot of lefties liked it. Obama really liked it. In fact, there was an interview with let's put the phone on silent before somebody interrupts. Yes, Obama did an interview with somebody, and he was asked what he likes watching, and he singled out The Wire as an excellent example of TV. So a lot of people have watched it, you know, because it was good and because of his recommendation. And there's a lot of analysis of The Wire, because it's quite gritty, it's quite real, and so loads of papers have been written on it, courses have been done on it. Almost all of those have been done from a left-wing Marxist perspective. So, you know, you can imagine all of these people going through university who are trained in Marxist deconstruction of basically, well, people do bad things if they're not white because of capitalism and systemic failures and stuff like that. Not entirely my takeaway, I've got to say. I think I've come up with something, you know, a little bit different. But yes, worth covering all the same. The other thing that I found quite interesting watching it all these years later is I have a slightly different lens now, 20 years later, on, should we say, group dynamics. So I was able to draw a lot more deeper stuff on character motivation than when I watched it the first time round 20-odd years ago. So that was, yes, that was interesting. Let's hint at some of that, maybe after the YouTube people have gone. But yes, rather than the Marxist perspective, I actually think this series can be summed up quite beautifully in the very first scene of the very first episode. So, I mean, I'll spoil that bit, but don't worry, it's not much of a spoiler because I say it's the first scene of the first episode. There's been a murder, and the kind of our main character, Jimmy McNulty, is sat there talking to a witness of this murder to figure out what happened, because he's a homicide detective. And basically, you get this story unfold of this character. What was he called? It was called Snot, I think. That was his nickname. They all get nicknames. The hood guys, they get, well, actually, the cops get nicknames as well. This guy, you know, he forgets to wear his coat one day, and it's a bit cold, and he gets lumped with a nickname Snot for the rest of his life. And basically, what was happening is these chaps were having a, probably wasn't poker. They were playing some sort of card game every Friday. And the money would build up on this table. And when it got to a certain point, there'd be a big stack of cash on the table. The recently deceased Snot could not help himself but grab the money and run out the door. He just couldn't help himself. He just couldn't do it. And normally what happened is they would chase him and they'd give him beating and they'd get the money back. And then next week he would do the exact same thing, and when the money built up, he just couldn't help himself. He'd steal it and run out the door. And on this particular occasion, somebody new came to the game, and he was winning, and when he saw this money being grabbed and the guy running out the door, he shot him, which is, well, it's bad. I happen to think that, you know, fair enough. And yeah, anyway, there's a whole interplay, and it's quite interesting on that. Now, actually, rather than all the sort of Marxist deconstruction of capitalism, I think that opening scene of the entire thing basically captures the whole story. You know, it's certainly season one, but all of it. It is the battle between high time preference and low time preference individuals, with the majority of the low-time preference individuals falling on the drug side, but actually it's rife within the police department as well.
You know, Avon, you got to think about what we got in this game for, man. Huh? Was it the rep? Was it so our names can ring out on some fucking ghetto street corners, man? Nah, man, there's games beyond the fucking game.
I'm not going to explain that particularly well at this stage, but I will go through it and you'll see what I'm thinking. But Jimmy McNulty, our homicide kind of main character guy, he has a lone type preference. He wants to achieve results and he's willing to forego immediate gratification. And this Snot chap, who's lying dead on the floor in a pool of blood, he has a very high type preference. You know, he just wants it now. And he can't help himself when he sees it in front of him. And that goes for, I mean, that goes right up to the chief of police. This preference for let's just get a quick win now and pass it on, and that for me is if you haven't watched it and you watch it in that lens, it kind of explains all of it. So, The Wire, for those of you who may not be familiar, like I say, really good TV. It was made by a guy called David Simon, and he had spent 20 years working for the Baltimore Sun, the newspaper, as their police correspondent. And so he's got a really deep understanding of Baltimore, how the police work, how the drug trade works. I mean, he was reporting on it. And they used a lot of real characters in this TV series. They brought in a lot of real expertise. So one of the detectives that you're introduced to later on, and he's not in it much, but he pops up now and again. He was a former police chief. They actually put him in the show, and it turned out he could act a bit. One of the majors that you spend a lot of time with in season three, he's got a lieutenant who is also a fairly senior police officer. You can he's not quite as good at acting; he's a bit wooden, but that's because he was a real policeman. They've got a Christian pastor guy who actually was a drug lord in Baltimore. I mean, he's old in the series, but in his youth, he was a drug kingpin, and he's in the series. And there's a whole bunch of characters in it in tertiary roles that have actually from that life. So that, along with the show writer, meant that this thing, I mean, I've never been to Baltimore, but I've been told that it is very accurate, gritty, real. You know, people who are familiar with that life say it is remarkably accurate. So it is a useful representation as you can get in fiction for a deconstruction of an issue that you can relate to and see it work and draw relevant economic lessons. So, yeah, so you've got this diverse range of characters. Not just the drug runners and the kingpins and the police and so on, but you also dive into other aspects of it. So season one is just about the cops and drug guys. Season two, they bring in the seaport system. So the stevedores, the people who unload the ships. And I mean, I'll talk more about that later, but the way that is basically falling apart because America doesn't make anything more, but it is still a route in for drugs and other stuff.
We used to make shit in this country, build shit. Now we just put our hand in the next guy's pocket.
Season three, that was about government and corruption. Season four was the schools, and season five was the media, the newspapers. Influenced by real world events, very gritty, very real. So great.
Yeah, I ain't no suit wearing businessman like you. You know, I'm just a gangster, I suppose. And I want my corners.
Where a lot of the left wing analysis of this, and you will find hundreds of videos on YouTube about an analysis of The Wire, and as far as I know, this is going to be the only one which is from a right wing perspective. But if you watch any of the other ones, they're going to tell you how the drug trade is not just criminal activity, but they will say something like it's a complex parallel ecosystem with its own rules, hierarchies, economic pressures. Agree with all of that. And then they go on to say, and it's a shadow economy, which is for those who have been excluded from the mainstream job market. Not really, no. Go back to that lens that I talked about at the beginning. It is a parallel economy for those who lack the characteristic traits that you would need to be basically functional in any real world economy job. One of them does actually make it. So one of the secondary characters from the first and second and third season, he does eventually get out of the drug trade and he goes and works in a shoe shop or something. But for even a basic job like working in a shoe shop, there are certain set of skills that you need to have. You need to have basic level conscientiousness. I mean, you need to turn up every day on time for a start. And for people with screwed up time incentives, even that is something that they fail at. You see the people involved in this trade, they're not necessarily, some of them are quite dumb. Some of them actually have a half decent brain on them. But what they lack is that level of conscientiousness that would be a starting requirement for any normal job. And also they are unable to respond to the incentives that a normal job would impose, because a normal job would have a fairly basic set of incentives. Turn up on time, do the work, don't screw up, get paid. Because these guys are so low in conscientiousness, industriousness, those basic tasks they struggle with, even though they are demanded in the drug trade, if you don't turn up, you don't get paid at all, and you might get a beating. If you miscount the stash, as one of the younger characters talks about halfway through the first season, you get a beating because, you know, one of the older ones, he's trying to teach, because these young kids, they're also going to school and getting involved in the drug trade. And he was trying to show him a basic algebra calculation. and the guy wasn't getting it, the kid wasn't getting it, and so he expressed it in drug terms, and the guy got it straight away, and he asked, well, how come you couldn't understand this example, but I just gave you a harder example about counting heroin caps, and you got it right straight away. And the kid said, yeah, because if you screw up the count, you get a beating. And for certain types of individuals, that is the only incentive structure that they are actually going to effectively respond to. And thus they end up in this parallel economy. If you follow some of the higher up individuals in this series, you see them facing the same kind of product pricing strategy, supply chain issues, human resources issues, competition issues that you would see in any big corporation. It's just a bit more entertaining because it's about drugs, and every so often somebody gets shot, which is, well, no, that's not funny, but you get my point. You've got the main kingpins, certainly for season one, characters like Avon Barksdale, Stringer Bell, who are the upper echelons of this drug economy. And they've got this whole different dynamic, which, again, you see they're very different characters. You've got the mid-level managers, which in season one is all about this D'Angelo Barksdale, the nephew of the main guy, doing basically the front-end operations, the day-to-day trading, facing pressures from above and below. You've got the street-level dealers. We introduced to, you know, a guy called Bodie, and a Wallace guy and a Poot guy, who are basically at the maximum inflection point between risk and reward. Basically, they get a lot of risk because they could be beaten by their own higher-ups and certainly by rival gangs. And then you've got the low levels. What do they call them? The runners or the... I forget what they call them now, but the runners and something else, the low level kids who actually take the money and hand off the drugs and run to the stash and run to the client and, you know, take the money back to the boss guys, who, as we talk about later, are on basically less than minimum wage, but they're in an incentive structure that works for their character.
Hey, yo, what's up, Playboy? How come you wearing that suit, B? For real? It's 85 fucking degrees out here and you trying to be like Pat Riley.
Man, look the part, be the part, motherfucker.
So you get those stark inequalities between the drug levels. In fact, let's talk about the characters. Let's give you a quick run through of the main characters before we get into some of the deeper levels I've learned from this. So, Jimmy McNulty. Jimmy McNulty is a Irish-American... police homicide detective, and his personality is all about being rebellious. He doesn't like chain of command, but he's got something to prove. He's got that Northern European, I'm gonna innovate, I'm gonna improve something, I'm gonna deliver a result. And you kind of left to root for him because he wants to get stuff done. He's woefully unsuitable for his environment. Because what he does is he does that Northern European thing of internalizing what the system is trying to achieve. And he understands, okay, we've got this drug trade, and we can take, hoppers, that's what they call them, hoppers and runners. And he realizes, okay, we can be taking out the hoppers and runners all day long. It doesn't make a damn bit of difference because every kid we take off the street and we charge and we bang up, there's another 10 of them waiting to go. So all we're doing is churning the low level. And he gets this idea into his head that he wants to start moving up the value chain. And in order to do that, you need to put a wire on their phones and their pagers, thus the name of the show. So he engineers a situation where he can go after this. His bosses, however, are many generations in to a dysfunctional system that has attempted to solve all of these problems through the media of setting targets, so that the politicians can then claim, well, we've set a target to reduce the drug trade or to do this or to make this number of arrests or whatever, and then have basically stopped caring about what actually happens after that. But they've aligned all these governmental and police level incentive structures to go and achieve these targets. So the optimized individual basically just does the job in front of them. And a lot of the police that you meet in season one and so on, they're quite happy to just to do the turn up, treat it like a job, treat it like a conveyor belt, arrest a hopper or runner, carry on, do it the next day, do the job.
It's Baltimore, gentlemen. The guards will not save you.
Jimmy McNulty is trying to actually fix the problem at the root. So he's an innovator and he's a problem solver. And as a result, it doesn't really work for him. Well, it kind of does a bit, but the system basically treats him as almost more of an enemy than the drug dealers, because he's trying to rock the boat of an established system where everybody is comfortable doing their TikTok factory turn up, do this, do that, go home. So yeah, main character, if you watch the series after this or if you remember it, yeah, main guy. Lester Fremont is interesting. He is an African-American formerly homicide detective who basically did a Jimmy McNulty and tried to do an end run around his bosses in order to actually get something done. Or as he described it, he tried to do good police work. They always say police. Anyway, so he tried to do good police work and he got shunted into like the records room for 14 years and 4 months. Until they forgot about him and he got bummed off on this special unit and he actually turned out to be a good policeman. So he's an example of a Jimmy McNulty 14 years and 4 months down the line. But he has some of the same motivations as Jimmy McNulty. It's just been beaten out of him at this point. So he's good police, but less passionate about it than McNulty, who's trying to prove how clever he is.
You follow drugs, you get drug addicts and drug dealers. But you start to follow the money, and you don't know where the fuck it's going to take you.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at LotusEaters.com.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.